listening to Synesthesia, produced live in studio at Trent Radio, 92.7 CFFF FM in beautiful Nagajiwinong, Peterborough, Ontario, every Thursday at 5 p.m. It's also a podcast on Soundproof, creative nonfiction for audio. I'm your producer and host, L.A. Alfonso, in this audio program. Film theory meets film music. Back in January 30th, 2022, Professor Richard Cousins came into our intellectual traditions in cultural studies class and talked some nonsense. And thinking through this nonsense, I wrote this response. I once heard a personal story about the brain's inner workings that makes a person erupt with laughter. As the idea goes, when listening to a joke, the setup engages the brain's left hemisphere, but then the punchline suddenly forces the listener to switch to the right. For example, the left brain may follow E-flat walks into a bar. But when the bartender says, "Sorry, we don't serve minors," our grasp quickly slips to the right. According to the hunch, this abrupt shift is what causes laughter, a sudden detour into nonsense. Can cause someone to laugh. The getting of laughs is the motor that drives the nonsense in comedies like Ernie Kovacs's Eugene, Tex Avery's Screwball Squirrel, and Charles M. Chuck Jones's Duck Amuck. Each short notably plays with defying the audience's expectations, with filmmaking conventions. Duck Amuck reveals the cartoon drawing process by having the pencil enter the picture frame to erase and replace Daffy Duck. The duck argues with his maker as the artist gets extra creative. The unseen cartoonist erases the body but keeps Daffy Duck's mouth, which continues talking, and draws an entirely new alien figure waving a flag that pictures a screw and a ball. Absurdist situations emerge from upending technical film rules and perspectives. For example, a squirrel can pick up a hole and move it to a different location. It strikes me that it must first oppose some accepted sense for something to be considered screwball or nonsense. Abstract art, for instance, the work of Jackson Pollock, is a unique expression worthy of being taken on its merit. The nonsense emerges only by comparing it to the history of painting before him. André Breton says, "The decisive act of surrealism was to show access to the flow from a spring that one need only go search for daily, deep down, within oneself. A flow whose course one cannot try to direct, for if one does, it is sure to dry up immediately." In Prague Le Gomina to a third surrealist manifesto or not. He says, all present systems can reasonably be considered to be nothing but tools on the carpenter's workbench. Breton says, this carpenter is you. From this idea, I take that surrealism can be a carpenter's tool, used for plumbing the depths of the self. Could we use its methods to find a previously unexplored space within ourselves to savor the juice of ambiguity? I'm immersed in discovering the liminal space from which the pre-language described by cultural theorist Charles Eisenstein in The Ascent of Humanity explodes. The original language, he says, can... can never be irretrievably lost, but only temporarily forgotten. Locked deep inside us, but ready to come out whenever we drop social inhibitions. Lovemaking, he notes, is one such occasion. Eisenstein says, the vocalizations of passionate sexual abandon are nothing other than the original language remembered. These utterances do not have meaning in the way ordinary words do, but they cannot be considered meaningless either. They are vectors of communication far more honest and intimate than any semantic exchange. In A Note on the Meaning of Nonsense, author Per Brandt writes, language disappears into the sacred music of nonsense in modern shamanic rituals. Nonsense motivated by a search for purity, says Brandt, is a bodily sacrifice of rationality. Perhaps we are in what André Breton calls pure psychic automism, which he identified as the guiding principle of surrealism. In On Surrealism in Its Living Works, the decisive act of surrealism, he says, was to show the inner flow that conjures phrases only previously described as half asleep or waking. Strong emotions elicit meaningless sounds. I'm also thinking of cooing, the cooing nonsense that erupts out of me when I meet a baby. Wow, 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 yeah, yeah. I've also observed utterances that spontaneously come out when confronting an animal. Cat is the most common example, but I've seen videos of humans encountering bears or owls as evidence in footage of women's first-hand encounters with big bears. I often see the animal scared away by the guttural spirit that takes over the lady to protect her loved ones. Does some internal switch get triggered while in dialogue with something other than human? Could we perhaps locate that liminal space between conscious and subconscious that allows for animal talk as the exact source of shamanic ramblings, blubberings, and nonsense? How else can one intentionally make meaningful nonsense? In Brandt's paper exploring its concepts, he writes about the S+7 method for poetry. In 1961, Jean Lescure, a member of the group of French writers named Oulipo, roughly translated Workshop of Potential Literature, suggested the method of replacing all nouns in a famous text with another noun found in a small dictionary seven steps further on. I experimented with Harlem by Langston Hughes using this method, but I don't think it turned out very funny. Here it is. What happens to a dress deferred? Does it dry up? Like a rally in the superbness and then run? Does it stink like rotten mechanic or crust and sugar over like a syrupy sweet sop? Maybe it just sags like a heavy loafer. Or does it explode? Jibber jabber or gobbledygook, a gibberish is another good trajectory for studying nonsense, focusing primarily on speech. For actors to tell a story about a person speaking a foreign language, they would often mimic the sound and cadence without actually replicating any specific words for anyone to understand to get their joke across. Did the etymology of the word boom shakalaka laka come from televised rituals and documentaries or merely improvised by comedians in a Hollywood cave set? The Slang Dictionary's entry on boom shakalaka laka says it's an exclamation that can express dominance, triumph, excitement, or joy. Sports spectators use it when commenting on big dunks in basketball. What can we take away from nonsense? I posit that it's an entry point into the body. Nonsense renders the body human. Nonsense is our natural state. Where sense might appeal to the intellect, nonsense can trip past the brain and ping the heart. You're listening to Synesthesia, produced live in studio at Trent Radio 92.7 CFFF FM in beautiful Nagajiwanong, Peterborough, Ontario, every Thursday at 5 p.m. It's also a podcast on Soundproof, creative nonfiction for audio. I'm your producer and host, Ellie Alfonso. In this audio program, film theory meets film music. At the Cultural Studies end-of-year get-together, I ran into animation guru Rick Cousins. On a whim, I asked Cousins if he could think of any first-person animated films that, and he sat there silently for a while, and I could almost hear his brain scanning through his encyclopedic reservoir of knowledge. And I gave him my notebook, and he jotted down a few titles, and I'm so grateful for his help. Now I think I have a tiny program of animated films in which the producer or animators appear within their self-authored texts. Richard Linklater's Apollo 10 and a Half, A Space Age Childhood from 2022 could perhaps count as a first-person film in which Linklater performed his authorship through the writing and directing as much as Jennifer Fox did in The Tale in 2018. Under Rick Cousins' notes, I scribbled some of my own. One line said, "Scenic route," which refers to Rick's advice to me when I confessed that I was puzzling something out. "Take the scenic route," he advised. "Helps you forget about it." Okay, let's take a musical detour right here. And I will play a great find I recently found at Blue Streak Records, where they have rare records and CDs right on George and Hunter in Peterborough, Ontario. I'm going to play this track from music from the film The Violin and Folk Songs and Dances from Around the World by Maurice Solway. It's on vinyl, folks. There you have it. That was Maurice Solway, a forgotten Canadian composer. That's music from the film The Violin. And if you're an animator out there, I invite you to maybe make an animation out of that piece. It's called Judicial Polka, a 5/4 grotesque piece full of humor and charm. And I just thought, since we're talking about animation, I'd play that rare recording on vinyl, and I happen to have a copy that was signed by Maurice Solway himself. We're talking about animation, and guess who's here?
Is it me?
It's you.
It's me.
What?
What am I doing here?
It's Professor Richard Cousins.
Hello there. How you doing,
folks? And he's coming to talk about animated films because. Would you say that's your expertise? Or?
That is what I did my doctoral dissertation on. Yes, I have studied a number of things, everything from dramaturgy to radio comedy to animation in a lot of different contexts. My dissertation was actually on anthropomorphisms in animation. In other words, why are talking animals in cartoons such smart asses? And what does that mean for the rest of the culture? I was just thinking as you were playing that Maurice song with it, it put me very much in mind of the scores for a number of NFB animated films by Maurice Blackburn. It has very much of the same sort of feel, sort of mid-20th century, semi-avant-garde type of feel that Maurice Blackburn was putting into his scores for films by people like Norman McLaren and so forth.
Yeah, very cool. Yeah, you mentioned Norman McLaren as one of the people, because I was particularly interested in those animators who show themselves on screen and they somehow commingle in some way with their animated creations. And Norman McLaren did that in his film Opening Speech.
Yep.
Was that in the 60s?
Yeah, I believe so. It was done in lieu of making an opening speech for a conference, because McLaren was sort of a very self-conscious person, kind of publicity shy, even though he did appear as as what amounts to an animated puppet in a lot of his films. For example, A Cherry Tale is another one that comes to mind, where he was appeared both in live action and in pixelation, in pixelated form, in that film. And in Opening Speech, he's kind of playing out his anxieties at delivering this opening speech to a conference. And, you know, as you've seen and as those who have seen it will know, he gets into rather a struggle with his equipment, with the microphone. Don't get any ideas, by the way, microphone number two in the studio here. I don't want you to start, you know, wrapping your cord around my neck or going up and down. As long as we have a decent level here, you know, we're all on the same page. Good, because this is not a Norman McLaren film, Mr. Microphone number two. Thank you very much.
So, but, yeah, for those who haven't seen it, it is available on YouTube, and I will link all of the movies that we'll talk about in the show notes. So Norman McLaren goes on stage, but he struggles with a microphone that has a mind of its own, and it tries to kind of turn away whenever he tries to say start, and he literally wrestles with it at some point. And he goes through the gamut of what a microphone can do, right? Like extending itself, going downwards, you know, and
going upwards, running off stage. At one point, I think he actually has to hog tie the thing
right
towards the end to get it to, I recall correctly, and yeah. If I don't,
he nails down the legs of the microphone.
The microphone stand.
Yeah, the microphone stand. So, that's an interesting, almost like an autobiography, like you say, like he's playing out his anxieties, but it's also, that's almost like a personal take. You also talked about Dinky Doodle, the Dinky Doodle series by Walter Lantz.
And who doesn't know the Dinky Doodle series by Walter Lantz? I think we all grew up with that as children, you know, sitting down on a Saturday morning with our bowl of Cocoa Puffs watching Dinky Doodle. No, clearly not. Here's the context here. Walter Lantz, who, those of you who know the name will know for Woody Woodpecker primarily, got his start as an animator in silent films. And that's not just silent, fully animated films, but also animated parts of other silent films. There was a bit of a tradition in silent film comedies, particularly shorts, to have little animated inserts in them, playing along, a little animated devils appearing on people's shoulders, for example. That's one that comes immediately to mind from a Harry Langdon film, or the skull and crossbones on a bottle of poison, all of a sudden winking at the camera, that sort of thing. And Walter Lantz, as a semi-independent animated producer, also made this series of films called Dinky Doodle, and starring Dinky Doodle and his dog Weak Heart, which were animated characters that Lantz himself had drawn and starred in live action opposite. So it was a competent mashup of live action and animation, you know, 60 years before Roger Rabbit, but also very much in a tradition that had already been established by Max and Dave Fleischer in their Out of the Inkwell series, which had sort of a double autobiographical component to it, I guess you could say, because they came to this series as a result of an experimental film that they made with a new invention that they'd literally created in their parents' living room. And this invention was called a rotoscope. And for those of you who don't know what a rotoscope is, very quickly, what it does is allows you to trace over blown up individual frames of motion picture film and thus animate them. You don't necessarily have to trace the drawings exactly. You can use the animated film as references, and as Fleischer Studios got more used to the rotoscope, they did some very sophisticated things with it. In the 30s, they made a series of films, three of them featuring Cab Calloway, rotoscoped into Betty Boop films, into musical numbers in Betty Boop films. So if you want to check out Minnie the Moocher or Snow White or Old Man of the Mountain, you will actually see a rotoscoped Cab Calloway, but unrecognizable because it's a character doing the movements that Calloway had done on live-action film as reference. Anyway, rewind to 1920. The Fleischer brothers are in the living room of their apartment in New York City, and Max has invented this thing. He's clutched this thing together that takes up the whole living room, and they want to test it. So he gets Dave to go onto the roof of the apartment building, dressed in a clown suit, dancing around for a while in the clown suit. They take film of it, and then they trace the film. And you have a dancing, animated, rotoscoped clown in a film that was known as Out of the Inkwell, and they managed to score a series of films off of that. And the conceit in the Out of the Inkwell films was that Max, who wasn't actually the artist, as it turned out, was sitting at a drawing board, and he would draw this clown, who became known as Coco. He'd draw this clown onto a drawing board, and the drawing would come to life and eventually enter the live-action world and go back into the world of the drawing board, depending on what the plot of the particular film held in store for poor Coco.
That kind of reminds me of A Man with a Movie Camera, because it was Ziga Vertov, but mm-hmm. It was his brother that played the person actually operating the camera. Who's credited to be operating the camera, but that can't be because we're seeing the camera shot by another camera. So does that mean Dave Fleischer was the one that was actually the actual artist?
Dave Fleischer was an animation director, at least, insofar as he supervised the animation staff. Now, Max was a graphic artist, he was a cartoonist, but as far as doing the actual animation for the Out of the Inkwell series, he didn't really have his hand into very much of it. He was the public face of the series, but like a lot of other famous names in animation who get a lot of credit for doing it all themselves, Walter Lantz being one of them, although for Dinky Doodle, Lantz was the principal animator. Lantz didn't do a lot of direction in the years when he was famous, and Walt Disney also gets credit for stuff that he actually never drew himself, starting with Mickey Mouse. Again, credit where it's due. Disney himself started as an animator, making advertisements and also animated political cartoons to show in cinemas in Kansas City, and out of that came something that is semi-autobiographical in the sense that the first series that Disney did kind of also shows the visible hand of the animator and examines, you know, what it is to create an unreal world out of nothing. But again, as you said, you've got this amanuensis, you've got this stand-in, like Vertov's cameraman in this particular series of Disney's, which are known as the Alice comedies, which began with Alice in Cartoonland, which was really the only one in the series that showed the actual animator's hand at the beginning of the whole process. The framing device was that this child named Alice came to visit Disney and his three friends in their little studio in Kansas City. It was a very, very small staff. And she came to see how animated cartoons were made. So right from the outset, you know, this is someone who is interested in showing the workings of the medium, showing how animated cartoons are put together. And she falls asleep and dreams that she, in live action, walks into a cartoon world. And that's the central idea behind this entire series that carried Disney from Kansas City to Hollywood over several years before he switched over full-time to just animation for a little while before picking up the combination of animation and live action again and various projects. But again, this is something where, you know, some of the animator's personal life gets played out on screen. Now, some of their concerns with how to portray things, maybe some of their anxieties about the precariousness of their existence too. Because remember, we think of Disney as having basically more money than six different gods put together, but at the time he was Disney was working on a shoestring, working hand to mouth for really the longest time. And if he was even working hand to mouth, for example, through World War II and after the 1940s, and always having to go hat in hand for more money to backers, the original Laugh-O-Gram studio that Disney ran in Kansas City was really run on a shoestring. This is a cottage industry to end all cottage industries. It's in someone's garage, basically. It starts in someone's garage, and they're trying to get that studio actually made into a National Historic Site. I know I'm going off on a tangent here, but you can go where Disney's old studio was if you care to go to Kansas City, and it's this rundown, bombed out warehouse in what's now a slum.
Wow. So that's very interesting. And it's also, I think, just on to note, 2024 marks the year where Steamboat Willie goes into the public domain.
Yep.
And just going to play some music from Steamboat Willie right there. Because we can now, without getting sued. What do you think of that? What do you think about copyright?
We forget how new a thing copyright actually is. It's something that was a source of active debate all the way through the 19th century. Copyright laws as we know them, certainly the strong copyright laws that we have now are very, very new. And you know, again, all the jokes about Disney finally having karma catch up with them because of Disney's use of public domain material, you know, to essentially make the studio's name are all well founded, because it's one of the things about, you know, one of the things about copyright is it has to be both narrowly and broadly applied at the same time. You know, if you think of the idea of applying copyright to an entire work as well as a specific part of that work that makes that work unique and not like other works, it's a very difficult thing to actually nail down. And it's, you know, it's why it's not necessarily, copyright is not necessarily something that's enforced unless you have a lot of time and a lot of money to get some really good lawyers to make the best arguments possible, which is why Disney can threaten so many people off. And interestingly enough, most of the listeners out there are probably familiar with the version of the Disney corporate entity that can just sue anybody at the drop of a hat. You may remember even the one where they tried to sue the Royal Canadian Mounted Police for infringing their trademark because they'd somehow gotten a hold of the Mountie look as a and tried to register it as a Disney copyright, or suing the city of Winnipeg for having a statue of Winnie the Pooh, which Winnie the Pooh was from Winnipeg, folks. It's true, he was. It's really one of the great success stories. Winnie the Pooh, you know, he goes from stealing cars at Portage in Maine to being, a beloved children's character, thanks to A.A. Milne. No, I'm kidding about that last bit. Winnie the Pooh never stole cars in Winnipeg.
Okay, just to clarify.
It was Brandon. Okay. But, you think about Disney as basically someone who can bring down the Thor hammer of copyright anywhere they choose.
This Trent Radio might get a letter all of a sudden saying I'm playing something they don't want me to play. I want to play a track, actually, Rick. I don't know if you've heard this, but one of my favorite recordings of all time is an LP called Stay Awake, Various Interpretations of Music from Vintage Disney Films. And it has artists like Sinead O'Connor, Tom Waits, Ringo Starr, Sun Ra, Ima Sumac, James Taylor, Suzanne Vega, and Tom Waits. They got Tom Waits to do a version of his version of Hi Ho. So let's listen to Tom Waits' version of Hi Ho from Snow White. Thank you. You're listening to Synesthesia, produced live in studio at Trent Radio 92.7 CFFF FM in beautiful Nungajibwinang, Peterborough, Ontario, every Thursday at 5 p.m. It's also a podcast on Soundproof, creative nonfiction for audio. I'm your producer and host, L.A. Alfonso. In this audio program, film theory meets film music meets Professor Richard Cousins, who's my guest today. And we're talking about animation, all kinds of animation. And you wanted to talk about copyright, finish some a thought about copyright.
Yeah. We just heard the eighth dwarf, Gravely, or Tom Waits. Sorry, I couldn't resist doing the impersonation there. He also did a version of I Don't Want to Grow Up from Peter Pan, which is now running through my head, and I'll try not to let it distract me. What I was saying before Tom went down the coal mine was that Disney has this reputation for suing everything that moves now, and more or less successfully, or at least threatening people off their copyright more or less successfully. But this hasn't always been the case, and it hasn't always been the case as recently as my lifetime, because 50 years ago, underground comics were doing all kinds of things with Disney characters, and there really wasn't much they could do. They tried unsuccessfully to get this character named Mickey Rat pulled out of publication, but it just did not work. So again, people forget that Disney has not always been the almighty, all-powerful thing than it is now. I remember the lean days of The Fox and the Hound and all those movies where Kurt Russell went to Medfield College. But that's another story, better told at another time, to no one in particular.
Well, it might as well be a bedtime story for me, because I love Walt Disney. I'm willing to say that publicly now. But I love the lean, mean Walt Disney, the Walt Disney that was on, like, that was inventive, that was ahead of his time, that invented ways of being creative and working with others. Or was he always like a bad person? I don't even know his life story.
No, the thing, and credit where it's due, the thing Disney was absolutely best at when he was at his best as a studio boss was letting people do their thing. Disney as a corporation certainly gets this reputation for being very intrusive, very micromanaging, very hands-on, but it can be surprising to people, especially people who have heard some of the stories about Walt as a control freak, which he certainly was when he got his teeth into something. But part of the genius of his control is he would back off and let people do their own thing if he thought they were onto a good thing. And a lot of the more rebellious animators in his studio, after he started concentrating on features, were glad to be left with short subjects, because it led to things. It led to things that were maybe a little bit more freewheeling than the stuff that Walt more closely supervised. It's the cartoons starring Goofy that were directed by Jack Kinney during the 40s are absolutely hilarious. They're on a par for pure slapstick comedy and ironic voiceovers with anything that was being done at Warner's, which of course gets the reputation for that sort of thing, anything that was being done at Warner's at the time.
Are you into animation theory?
I have to be into animation theory. I teach a course called The Anthropology of Animation that covers a little bit of animation theory, also a bit of narrative theory, dramatic theory, and tries to help people see how those who made cartoons are trying to work out what's going on in the world around them, possibly without even knowing it. But yes, I am into animation theory, and animation theory is into me.
Well, it's new to me, and it's every time a new thing comes into my radar, I think, wow, it fills a gap that I didn't even know there was a gap there to begin with. And as I read more and more about it, and of course I don't have time to put any more extra reading onto my plate, but I just find it completely fascinating. I stumbled onto a book called Animating Film Theory, and it's in the open source. And it sort of, you know, it's a bunch of essays that sort of makes the case that animation's been ignored in film theory, and where has it been? I mean, isn't animation the same as the history of animation? Didn't animation begin when film began? Because films are...
Pretty much, yeah.
Films are whatever frames per second, right? So
That is exactly what one of the contributors to Animating Film Theory, which was edited by Karen Redrow Beckman, this is exactly what one of the contributors, an Australian scholar by the name of Alan Cholodenko, says in another work. He starts off a journal article from, I think, about 2016 by saying, all film is a form of animation. And if there are any of my students listening to this, you will be familiar with this because you had to respond to that quote on the discussions board in week two, I believe it was. No, I'm sorry, week one. Week one, I've lost track.
Well, week one becomes week nine so fast. And definitely post the show on your bulletin board so you could get responses perhaps. Yeah, there's so many interesting articles in that book, and there's even an article by Tess Takahashi that says Framing the Postmodern, the Rhetoric of Animated Form in Experimental Identity Politics documentary video of the 1980s and 90s, which is right up my alley in terms of the personal experimental identity politics videos, first-person films, and early animation, the personal experimental work of Peggy Awesh, Betsy Bromberg, Bruce Elder, Nina Fonaroff, Sue Friedrich, Malcolm Legris, David Rimmer, Barbara Sternberg. I just recently saw Sunday in Peking in 1956 by Chris Marker, and it has an animated sequence in it, and I was just blown away. It was a shadow puppets, but it was also... He was also photographing photographs like animation and cutting them like animation and cutting them with live action. And as I'd written also elsewhere, animation works well for documentaries. And some of my favorite ones, I played the first track in this episode. I played, that was from Persepolis, Marjane Satrapi's Persepolis from 2007. And also I would have to add Ari Folman's Waltz with Bashir and Keith Maitland's Tower, some of the greatest animated documentaries ever made. Do you have any favorites?
And animation as documentary is a surprisingly old form. You're mentioning a lot of more recent works, but the one that comes to mind where animation is being used to document something, granted for a propagandistic purpose, dates from 1917, and it's by Winsor McKay. He did an animated version of the sinking of the Lusitania, and it was intended to get the American public to support the United States entering World War I. The Lusitania was a cruise ship which had been sunk by a German U-boat back in 1915, and a number of prominent Americans went down with the ship to their deaths. And in 17, as public support was starting to galvanize for the U.S. entering World War I, McKay finishes this animated documentary showing what it must have been like to be aboard the Lusitania as the torpedo hit. And it's meticulously done. There's a lot of what we would now call effects animation. In other words, animation of clouds going through the sky and, of course, the waves and the ocean. So point-of-view shots involving fish, that's not meant to be flippant, but there are some point-of-view shots involving fish and so forth. And just this spectacularly, meticulously drafted stuff, which was rivaling anything that could have been done in live action, either with models or or with, you know, you would have needed to have sailed a full-scale boat out to sea and sunk it to get the point across. But this was, it was all the more striking for how it framed this still contemporary event as far as people are concerned, this newsworthy event that was getting people to think about whether the U.S. should commit to what at the time was the biggest and bloodiest war in history. And again, so that just goes to show you how old the documentary, the animation in the documentary form can be.
Could you make the argument, though, that film is based on photography and animation is... The apparatus that's used for the animation is not the camera per se, but the projector.
The
projection apparatus.
Again, I think this is part of what's behind Chaludenko's quote, right? That nothing really comes to life until you run the film through the projector, whether it's a series of images taken of drawings of Bugs Bunny, or whether it's a series of images taken as Humphrey Bogart goes through his paces on a film set. They're all just a bunch of still pictures, and without the mechanical apparatus to set them in motion, you don't have the illusion of life. You would have to look at them very slowly in turn and start to form the idea that these things are moving, form a narrative in your head. So in that sense, in the sense that what you're really dealing with, whether you're using a camera to, whether you're letting the motion picture camera or the video camera just run and document events as they're unfolding in the real world, or whether you're using it to take discrete images that you stage manage and generate and arrange and in some form, when it runs back, the overall effect on the viewer is the same. You're watching something that is at least purporting to be a document of some type of movement, of some type of life. Another good theorist, if we're still on film and animation theory, another good theorist to consult who speaks about just exactly what life in animation really means is a fellow by the name of Thomas Lamarre, L-A-M-A-R-R-E. Thomas Lamarre has a lot to say on the subject of what the animated image is and what sort of life, what sort of vitality it possesses.
I just happened to catch this line in front of me. Sergei Eisenstein wrote that animation had a quality of plasmaticness that destabilizes forms and mesmerizes spectators in the same manner as fire. A similar effect occurs with a lava lamp, in my opinion, but there is a difference between machine-made screensavers and observing natural, unpredictable processes. The author points out that the necessary duality at the core of animism. As they say, it takes two to tango. If it moves, he says, then it is alive. But also the observer who endows life to these forms with both the eye and the body. He writes of serpentine lines, gothic lines, and a kind of pleasure in seeing lines. This reminds me of a video I made that starts out with a line. Len Lai's artistic focus is the expression of energy, and that author notes that his work cuts across traditional definitions of media. I mean, Len Lai scratched onto the film, so it, in a way, that's
scratched
not...
Scratched and painted and...
So that's not photography, using...
And
the
and used
apparatus
as paint-soaked
as a vandal.
Rags and porous, other carrying media as a way of creating each individual frame. He's McLaren, who was a contemporary colleague of Lai's at the GPO, the General Post Office film unit in Britain, before before McLaren came over to the to Canada, to the NFB, is probably more meticulous than Lai is from frame to frame. I always get the sense that Lai has a certain aleatory aspect to the way he proceeds. He's much more willing to let chance.
Aleatory, random, or chance.
Yeah, aleatory, random, or chance. He's much more willing to let chance determine his next move or his next couple moves down the road. That's something that's evidenced in Lai's work outside the world of film. If you've seen his kinetic sculptures, these are sculptures, folks, that are made of like fiberglass and bits of wire, and they either have little motors in them or some sort of apparatus that allows them to just essentially move at random. So if you think of, say, if you know what a mobile is, for example, one of those things that just hangs down and moves around in the breeze, think of something that's stuck on the floor, almost like a potted plant made out of wire. That's what a lot of these things look like, and they're just left to dance around. And you can go into any place where one of Lai's kinetic sculptures is still on display and go. Someone's at the door. You can go in. And speaking of aleatory, speaking of the effects of chance, you can go in and look at one of Lai's kinetic sculptures, step out again, and come in again, and you're not going to see the same show twice.
I just find it fascinating that he went from scratching on film to kinetic sculpture, and I think it kind of gives me a glimpse into what makes this artist tick or what he's trying to solve or puzzle out, and maybe taking the scenic route and finding his way out of there.
Oh yeah, you want to talk about the scenic route? I mean,
well, we have 2 minutes, maybe 1 minute left.
He took about 20 years to finish the one the one direct piece of direct animation scratch on film, Free Radicals.
Oh wow!
Yeah,
I did not know that. Yeah. I could talk to you for hours, Rick. Thank you so much for coming and visiting Synesthesia. This is Synesthesia, produced live in studio at Trent Radio 92.7 CFFF. FM in beautiful Ngadjiwinong, Peterborough, Ontario. Yes, that's a lot of Fs.
That's more Fs than Trent University is going to hand out this year.
I'm going to play one of my favorite tracks from Stay Awake. This is Someday My Prince Will Come from Sinead O'Connor. I'll see you next week.
Someday. So we'll go to be happy.